This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We're glad to have all of you back. Last week, if you recall, we started looking at the impact of the ACA, and we had speakers from the HHS regional office, and covered California, and two of our faculty here from UCSF to talk about Medicaid impacts on Medi-Cal, and then also about workforce and delivery system implications. Well, tonight we're going to drill down a little more on that last part, and we have five panelists who are leaders in various healthcare delivery systems in San Francisco and the Greater Bay Area to talk about how the ACA is affecting the provider community. And to moderate that discussion, we have Mr. Garen Corbett. Mr. Corbett is the director of the California Health Benefits Review Program, which is operated by the UC Office of the President. And Dr. Yellen and I have the pleasure of working with him on a number of projects. Sometimes I think it feels like we are working on him when we try to tell him how to do his job. But nonetheless, and prior to coming to the University of California, Mr. Corbett was at Brandeis University in the Heller School of Social Policy and was Deputy Director of the Health Industry Forum. Prior to that, he worked in the private sector in healthcare also for the state of Massachusetts as an insurance regulator. So I'm going to turn it over to Garen and let him introduce our panelists.
Great. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. It is a pleasure. By Janet giving a fairly long introduction for myself, I have to modulate about how long I pay attention to the distinguished panelist here to my left. So let me first introduce Jack Stobo, who is my boss, so that's why I wanted to introduce him first. He is Senior Vice President for Health Sciences and Services and tries to work on a number of system-wide initiatives for UC Health. He has over 40 years of healthcare leadership executive experience and has a very long and distinguished career. To his left is Mark Larratt. I think many of you in this room may recognize who he is. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the UCSF Medical Center, as well as the Benioff Children's Hospital, and he has been in this role since 2000, and he has a 30-year he's a 30-year veteran of healthcare management and is a national leader in healthcare reform and initiatives as well. It's a pleasure having him here as well. And each of you should have everyone's bios, so feel free to look in greater detail at the long and tremendous experience of each of these panelists. To Mark's left is Kevin Grumbach, who is professor and chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine here at the University of California, San Francisco. And he serves a number of other roles. He is co-director on many different things and has a tremendously expert perspective to give us tonight. To his left is Murray Ross, who's vice president and director at the Kaiser Institute for Health Policy in Oakland. Murray also spends much of his time traveling and on the East Coast as well. And Murray is a national leader on healthcare reform. He was director of MedPAC in Washington and brings tremendous expertise from Kaiser as well. And finally, to his left is Richard Slavin, who's the CEO of the Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And he has been in this role since 2010 has a tremendous expertise as a surgeon for 35 years and many other tremendous expertise to bring to us as well. So again, all of our bios are here. I don't want to spend a lot of time with that, and instead want to kick us off for some terrific conversation tonight. So as you have heard through these different sessions, the ACA is really having a profound impact on our country's healthcare system. You heard the first session of this session was kicked off by Dr. Stuart Altman, who was my former boss at Brandeis, where he sort of walked through how did we get to healthcare reform And now we've since moved along into really exploring how it's really having a fundamental impact on our entire country and healthcare delivery. We're going to be talking about the impact on healthcare providers today. But I hope that all of these, this excellent program really weaves a remarkable tale of how we got here. And it's really been a 100-year journey that has gotten us to this point. And so, you know, leading to tonight, the ACA has certainly been a tremendous accelerant for change. As we've talked about in these sessions, we're really seeing changes in how healthcare has been financed, how it's delivered, and who gets access to it and into what kinds of settings of care. Pressures to reduce cost, improve quality, and have a better patient experience have also ramped up as well. So how will providers respond? How have they already been impacted? We'll be exploring that. The ACA has also created much more transparency around the price of healthcare services, particularly with respect to insurance premiums. What goes into those rates is becoming much more open and is under much more scrutiny. And so now we're seeing in the past that patients wouldn't really shop around based on price because they were largely immune to the price. They didn't have big deductibles. They didn't know how much a standard service might cost. When you're paying with your employer's dollars or your health plans, you don't really think about it, but now you start thinking about the price tag. And increasingly, with high deductible health plans in the ACA, a lot of people have significant cost sharing up front. They're looking at that price tag in a different way. And this is called consumerism, and it's really starting to impact the behavior of consumers and healthcare purchasers. And of course, in addition to consumerism, you have a lot of activism, which I'm sure you heard more about last week, from the federal government and what the federal government is expecting, which is more with less dollars for healthcare providers. And that, of course, is driving a significant, I think, a part of what our conversation tonight will be. So I'm very delighted that we have a panel of such distinguished experts, and each will provide some comments, about 5 to 10 minutes, about how, again, the ACA is impacting providers. And in this terrific educational environment, I look forward to an evening of great conversation, sharing perspectives, and I just want to thank you all for being here, and again, for the panelists for being here as well. So I'll turn it over to Jack Stobo, and we'll have plenty of time for questions after each of the presenters. After all the presenters. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Karen. And let me thank all of you for being here this evening and your interest in what's going on in healthcare. The tumultuous times we're going through was reflected in a story about somebody who went to a national meeting. And they were staying outside with a group of his colleagues talking about the Affordable Care Act and the impact it was having. And everyone was bemoaning the situation they found themselves in. And finally, one person said, you know, this could be worse. We could be younger. I want to start off by making a comment about the environment and relative to or relate to what Garen said, how do we get here? And then talk a little bit about the influence the healthcare environment has on what we refer to as UC Health. UC Health is essentially a virtual organization that refers to all the health-related activities associated with the University of California. And that includes the 10 hospitals that are associated with 5 medical centers on 5 campuses in the state of California and 17 health professional schools that are located on 7 of the 10 University of California campuses. And so in my role in the Office of the President, looking over the whole system, I look at the impact that the Affordable Care Act and the environment has on that entire system and the tripartite missions of research, education, and clinical service that UC Health undertakes. One of the drawbacks of being 40 years in a position like mine is that I've gone through this once before. And that is in the mid-1990s, there was a lot of emphasis on ills of the healthcare system, particularly around cost and access. And it was an interesting time. People talked about health reform at that time, and I refer to that as healthcare reform without change. While there was a lot of pressure on doing things differently, nothing really changed. Cost didn't change very much. Our emphasis on quality didn't change very much. There's a lot of talk on access, but there wasn't a sea change or there wasn't a transformative change that occurred. In contrast, what we're going through right now is completely different. While there's some pressure externally from regulators, legislators, et cetera, much of the pressure for change is coming from within the profession. And it's established a momentum which, in my view, will transcend any piece of legislation or anything anyone else does and carry on, irrespective of whether the legislators keep chipping away at the Affordable Care Act like they're doing now or whatever else is done. That, coupled in the state of California with the state exchange, Covered California, means that a lot of things you'll hear tonight are going to continue to happen, irrespective of what happens in Washington or what happens in Sacramento. So this is real change. This is reform with change, as opposed to what many of us witnessed in the mid-1990s. Now, as I look at UC Health and the impact that the new environment has, as Garen said, the pressures are on cost of healthcare, the pressures are on access to healthcare, quality, safety, patient experience, et cetera. If we simply look at the impact on cost, our clinical delivery system, our physician practices, and our hospitals have been very successful financially over the last several years. And that financial success has not only accrued to them, but our medical centers provide significant programmatic support to our health professional schools, particularly our schools of medicine. In fact, the amount of financial support our schools of medicine and the University of California get from our medical centers is roughly 3 to 4 times the amount of money they get from the state. And without that support, I would submit, they wouldn't have the excellent faculty, excellent programs that they have now. So that support must continue not only to allow the medical centers to renew all the good things they do, but because of the support they provide outside the medical centers to parts of UC Health that are very important. Now, if we look at that reimbursement right now, we know that there are significant decreases in reimbursement. We are in the California Healthcare Exchange, Covered California, as a provider, both our hospitals and our physician groups. And to have a competitive price in the California Exchange, we had to take discounts in our hospitals and in our reimbursement to our providers, and which ranged anywhere from 11 to 23%. And when we're negotiating contracts now with insurers, we are looking at significant decreases in our reimbursement. Now, that's the environment. We accept that. The problem we have is we have a cost structure that is used to times when reimbursement was significantly higher. And we have to get our costs under control so we can continue not only to thrive financially, but to have the financial wherewithal to support the programs I mentioned. To do that, we have approached it in two ways. One is to look directly at cost, the infrastructure that we have, and to take a system-wide approach to things. So rather than just Mark looking at the costs associated with the medical center here at UCSF and somebody at UCLA, David Feinberg, taking a look at what they can do at UCLA, they need to do that. But we're also looking at what can San Diego, Irvine, UCLA, San Francisco, and Davis do together to leverage the power that those five campuses bring to things we do to address issues relative to quality, access, and cost. So we are looking at things like sharing infrastructure, et cetera, to take advantage of the scale the five medical centers provide to get our cost of infrastructure down, to spread the fixed cost among a wider base. But we're also looking at clinical performance. If we benchmark what we do in our hospitals and through our physician groups with other providers, in many cases we do exceedingly well. In some cases we don't do well. And we've taken a hard look at the areas in which we are not as good as we think we should be or we need to be. And try to identify a best practice within the UC system that allows us to deliver a higher quality, more cost-effective type of care. And it's pretty remarkable. If you look at one procedure, for example, we may have a best practice in San Diego, but not at Irvine, UCLA, UCSF, or Davis. You look at something else, and the best practice may be at Davis, but not at UCSF, Irvine, UCLA, or San Diego. So what we've been trying to do is identify that best practice and then spread that best practice throughout the system. So it not only addresses issues relative to quality and outcomes, but also issues relative to cost. To do that, we've established a system-wide center for health quality and innovation, whose only task is to identify and spread best practices throughout UC Health. And let me give you a good example. For cardiothoracic surgery, we do reasonably well in terms of outcomes and okay in terms of costs throughout the system. And if you look at the various steps that are involved in somebody who is having a coronary artery bypass surgery, for example, there's probably 11, which range all the way from what happens 3 weeks before they come in the hospital to what happens the first day in the hospital, what happens post-op, how much blood is given, are they on the a cardiothoracic pump, et cetera, to what happens through a month after they're discharged. And if we look at those 11 steps, and say we identify a best practice at one, and we've done that, and we've taken one of those steps in the best practice at UCSF. And if you drop that best practice into the other four centers and change their procedure only by inserting that one best practice, then immediately that's a $20 million benefit to the UC system for that procedure overall, and with much better outcomes. Now, what would happen if we dropped in 10 best practices in that? I can go on the list. You can look at liver transplants, heart transplants, knee replacement, hip replacement, et cetera. By identifying the best practice and replicating that best practice, not only do we get at the cost issue, but more importantly, we get at the outcomes issue. The patients have a better experience and a better outcome. So we have been spending a fair amount of time working at a system level, taking advantage of the scale a system approach brings to not only getting a hold of our fixed costs and infrastructure costs, but also identifying best practices and improving outcomes and costs for the patients we serve.
Thank you, Jack. Let me add my welcome to UCSF. We're sitting in the School of Nursing, which happens to be the number one school of nursing in the country, NIH dollars. Right next door is the School of Pharmacy, which is number one. The School of Dentistry is just down the road here a little bit. That's also number one. And the School of Medicine bumped Johns Hopkins, I can't remember that name. Jack used to be there, off its perch, and it's number one as well. So UCSF has the four professional schools that are number one in NIH in the country, and there's so much innovation going on here. So we welcome you to it, and it's your asset. So you should be very, very proud of it. I'll just make a few key points. University of California Hospitals, and in fact, the American Hospital Association, the Association of the Council of Teaching Hospitals, all were strong proponents of the Affordable Care Act. We all believed that something fundamental needed to change. Costs were going up. Patients were not getting the access they need. The health of the population was not improving, and there were wide swaths of individuals who were not covered, who had no access to health insurance. So we said, do something, even if it's imperfect. And then something has happened, and it is imperfect. It's really imperfect, but we're trying to work with it, and I'll talk about a few of the things that are challenges for us. Let me first talk about what we have done in response to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Jack talked about saving cost. We are trying to strip cost out of the hospital as fast as we can. And I'll tell you, it comes down, you know, sometimes you can imagine that maybe we can have fewer staff on the clinical units taking care of some needs for patients. Well, that's got some issues with it. Sometimes you say, well, let's reduce the high-cost drugs that we offer to our patients, but that also has cost to it because people are upset if you reduce those. So one of the things I've learned is there's no easy cost to just strip out of the hospital. There's some things like Jack talked about that we're learning from each other and finding ways to reduce costs, but it is hard work. Every dollar that you save means changing a process, changing the way we've always done something, and it can often affect patients. It's also, the Affordable Care Act has also put a real premium on improving quality and safety. We've been on this road for, you know, a decade and a half, but that also is a challenge when you're running a hospital, because let's say we want to, one of the things we're working on is reducing pressure ulcers, so skin breakdowns in the hospital. Very important issue. How do you do that? Well, the usual way that we've solved problems in the past is that we would hire another nurse who would go and do rounds and look at the patients and make sure that their skin was in good shape. But, gee, we're trying to reduce costs over here, but we want to improve that quality, so are there other ways that we can find to solve those problems? But we are making a lot of progress there. And then we also want to improve the patient experience. So if you reduce the number of staff that are taking care of patients, one of the things that patients can feel is neglected, and you don't want that to happen. So we're, what we have been trying to do since the implementation of the Affordable Care Act is completely reconceptualize how we deliver care. And I would say if there's any one theme I would say tonight that that is the imperative for every hospital and every healthcare provider is we've got to come up with a whole new way of delivering healthcare. I'll give you one example that has worked very well for us, and it involves the increasing use of technology. So in 2008, we had a rare but very serious episode here where a patient died as a result of an overdose that was administered by a nurse. And what was the cause of the overdose of the drug administered by the nurse? The nurse made an error with the decimal point. So instead of 1x of what the dose should have been, she inadvertently administered 10x of that drug, and it killed the patient. We did as we always do. We reported that to the state. The state came out and did a review of all of our systems and made a judgment that we needed to entirely overhaul our medication administration here at UCSF, which we proceeded to do. And one of the things we learned along the way is we relied on people too much. We relied on a nurse to do that calculation, and a lot of these weight-based dosing, so you're calculating how old the patient is and how big the patient is and kilograms and pounds and milligrams and so forth, and it's easy to make a mistake. So we made a number of changes. First thing we did is we implemented an electronic medical record. So now when Dr. Grumbach wants to order Tylenol for a patient, he doesn't just say, gee, how big is the Tylenol capsule that I'm going to order? He goes on and he orders Tylenol, and there's standardized doses for him. And if he wants to order a Tylenol and it's contraindicated because the patient is on another drug that would interact negatively with Tylenol, a little flashing bell will come up and a little sign, and it'll say, Dr. Grumbach, are you sure you want to give this Tylenol to the patient? And hopefully Dr. Grumbach thinks twice about it and says, no, I don't want to do that. But we implemented that system. So now doctors order electronically. The electronic order now goes to a robotic pharmacy that we built down at Mission Bay. And there is a robot that plucks the Tylenol tablet and puts it in a little plastic bag that's sealed with a barcode on it. That is the barcode for that patient for a certain time for that to be delivered. And then that medication with all that other patient's medications goes on a little ring. And so there's multiple little bags. That comes back to the hospital, and then the nurse gets an alert. Time to give Dr. Grumbach's patient that Tylenol. She takes that Tylenol, scans it with a card reader. What am I trying to say? Scanner. Barcode scanner. And it says, yes, this is the right medication. They scan the patient's wristband. Oh, yes, that's the correct patient. And, in fact, yes, this is the right time to be giving that med. And the nurse will also scan her ID card to show that she administered the drug at that point. We have probably had a 90-some percent reduction in medication errors since we implemented this fully automated system. Now, here's the thing about it. It cost us probably $30 million to put in the automated robotic system, and it cost us close to $180 million to put in the electronic medical record system, and obviously it's lots of training and so forth. But on the other side of it, we've reduced the number of pharmacists who are trying to count pills. We've reduced medication errors, so we've made care safer for patients. And we think it's a win-win-win. The real challenge with the Accountable Care Act is it's not easy for most hospitals to be able to afford to make the kind of changes that we did. We're a big place. We're about a $2.5 billion a year business. We're entirely self-supporting. The state of California pays nothing, gives nothing to the hospitals in the University of California system, just in case you were wondering. We operate entirely in a self-supporting manner. So most hospitals, but we generate a margin, so we're able to afford it. But most hospitals can't do that. But over time, this is the direction that all hospitals want to go. My biggest fears about the Affordable Care Act is that there are so many payment cuts coming to us. In fact, every year between now and 2020, hospitals are slated to take another payment cut because of the Affordable Care Act. So there's just one cut after another cut after another cut. So our payments are going to go down. And the question is, can we reduce our costs fast enough to keep up with it? Can we add enough technology to reduce the labor costs that are so high and in the hospital and implement more technology to make the place safer? So it's a real challenge, I think, for everybody in the healthcare industry today. But directionally, we're very supportive of moving in a direction to change the way we deliver healthcare to make it safer, better quality, better patient experience, and do it at far lower cost.
Good evening. Mark, you didn't say though. So if you go ahead and give the Tylenol pill, even though you get the warning, you didn't talk about the final warning, which is then an avatar of Mark comes on the electronic medical record that says, "Come see me in my office." So that's the foolproof, because we just click right by the warnings usually. What's interesting to hear Jack and Mark talk, because if you read the newspapers, what's all the attention about the Affordable Care Act tend to talk about?
Software.
That's right, the failures, and that's all about, so it's all about the signing up, but it's largely about the coverage issues, right? It's getting people insured, whether it's through Medi-Cal or going Covered California or healthcare.gov. And that's what you read about mostly in the newspapers, and then all the problems about the computers didn't work and the website was down. And that's absolutely important. I mean, it's a disgrace that we live in a nation which has 50 million uninsured people. As of January, we may get down to maybe half that many, if we're fortunate, depending on how many people sign up. That still puts us way outside where most nations are with virtually 100% coverage. So that was the fundamental goal of the Affordable Care Act, was to try to get towards universal coverage. The challenge, though, is, I mean, health insurance isn't the end in of itself. I mean, it's important to protect against bankruptcy if you get really sick or the cost of care. But why do you want health insurance? It's in and of itself, health insurance isn't the goal, right? I mean, what do you want with your health insurance? You want to stay healthy, get access to care when you need it, make sure it's good quality, make sure they actually care about you as a person, know who you are. It's safe, as Mark was saying. So insurance is just a means to the end. And you'd think with all the debate that all we're worried about, concerned about, is the means rather than the end. So I think what Jack and Mark are alluding to is there's really this whole other side of health reform. I think when Jack was talking about there's reform without change, the change now is recognizing that insurance coverage alone is not sufficient. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient to get to where we want to go as a country. And that's why people talk about the triple aims. I don't know, did that come up in any of the prior conversations? That's really now become the mantra of health reform. The triple aims meaning better health for the American people, better experience of care among patients getting care, and at an affordable price. So that's what we're really grappling with as providers of care, whether you're a family doctor like me or a CEO of a large hospital and health system or overseeing a whole, conglomerate of academic health centers. We're trying to think, how do we actually get to the triple aims? How do we provide better health for the people we're taking care of, people in our communities? How do we make sure their experience of care is more satisfying, more humane, and better quality? And then how do we actually do that at an affordable price? And so you confront the fact that we're in a very problematic place in the United States. It's hard to say we don't have enough money in the system, right? We spend twice as much per person compared to any other developed nation on health care. So it's just very poorly allocated. And we're all getting very poor value for the money we're spending. So that's a real challenge to providers, is can you change the way you deliver care? Can you work in a different way so we can take that $2.5 trillion we spend a year on health care and actually deliver the goods so that we're not last among 25 developed nations in annual rates of mortality that could be prevented by good medical care? I mean, isn't that a shocking figure? You know, with all the innovation, the ingenuity, the resources we have, the incredible, you know, medical centers like this, universities, Kaiser, Palo Alto Medical Foundation, that when you look at the big picture, we're a laggard in terms of our performance in health and healthcare delivery. So we're going to have to do something very different. So I start to look at this. So I am a family doctor. I take care of patients over their lifespan and families. And I realize a huge problem of this is care tends to be so poorly coordinated. So just think about your own experiences. For yourself, for a loved one, an ailing parent, a kid who was sick. How many of you went through that care process and said, everybody was on the same page? Everybody I encountered knew what was going on with my health. The specialist knew what the primary care doctor knew, you know, decided. The nurse knew exactly what was going on. When I went home, I knew exactly what medicines to take. I knew what the follow-up was going to be. I knew who to call. How many people that was describes their experience of healthcare? That's good. How many it did not describe your experience of healthcare? All right. So the goal is to get fewer of you raising your hands a second time and more of you raising the first time. So I'll just give you the classic experience. Why this is poor care for you, why it's ridiculously expensive, and it doesn't lead to better outcomes. So I had an elderly patient. She was about 80 years old that I'd taken care of for 20 years. She actually had immigrated from Cambodia. So as a refugee, had survived Pol Pot, Khmer Rouge. Many families had been killed in that horrible, you know, terrible time in Cambodia. Survived. Was here with her family, eventually got diabetes, had some heart problems, kidneys failed. And so we did our best and kept her out of the hospital as well as we could, preserve her quality of life. And then we talked about advanced directives, what some people would call the death panel discussion, right? But I asked her, what is your goal with your life? You know, you're getting more infirm, you're in pain, it's harder to walk around because it's harder to breathe, you go to dialysis three times a week. What are your goals for care? And she said, I'm not afraid of dying. I mean, I've survived so much longer than everybody I grew up with, who so many of whom died in Cambodia. I feel blessed that I've lived this long. I don't want to suffer. I want to have a decent quality of life, and when my time comes, I'm ready. So we did the advanced directive, do not resuscitate if she has a, you know, heart stops, if she stops breathing. We'd agree to that. I wrote it in the medical record. We even had an electronic medical record. And then one day she gets very sick all of a sudden, and her granddaughter, who is her caretaker, gets scared, of course, brings her to an emergency department. They don't have access to my electronic medical record. They said, "What? You know, she's going to die if we don't put her on a breathing machine right now in the emergency department. Do you want your grandmother to die?" What do most, you know, people say? No, of course, I love my grand. I mean, that's awful for a 25-year-old woman to sort of say, do you want to make the decision to kill your grandmother, essentially, as opposed to what do you want for, what are the goals, what's been the decision? So she said, no, I think then you better save her life. So then I find out, you know, the granddaughter calls me and 12 hours later, and I'm horrified. I say, that's wrong. You know, that was not at all what she wanted. So I come in, find her in the ICU with a breathing tube, unconscious. I look at all the numbers. She's clearly dying. She's had another heart attack. She's got an infection. So I talked with the ICU team, and I said, this is not what she wanted. She would not want this. And I talked with her granddaughter, so we decide to take her off the breathing machine. And she died peacefully within a few hours, which is, I think, how she wanted to go. But how many people stay in an ICU for day after day after day in the United States like that? Because we say, well, we can't let somebody die. because we have all the technology, all the machines. And you can go through any hospital in the United States and you will find many people who we are sort of just, I think, inhumanely doing things just because we can do it. I think we hopefully don't do it too much in our hospital, Mark. But I think, again, you will find people because of the culture, because all the incentive, all the payment is geared towards do more. And it's partly it played a different way because she had a primary care physician who knew her, who talked about her wish and preferences. And you see so many people that just bounce around from specialist to specialist, from hospital to hospital, because they don't have primary care. So one of the things we recognize in providing care is we need to get back and start doing some of the basic things. Like, it's great to have a place like UCSF when your kidney or when your liver fails and you need a transplant. This is where I'd come. But wouldn't it be good to have people actually thinking how to keep your liver from failing in the first place? Wouldn't that be a good proposition? If you have hepatitis, to manage it well, to talk to you about your alcoholism so you don't drink yourself to where you've sort of marinated your liver and it stops working. So that's one of the reasons care is so expensive in the United States. Why patient experience isn't good is because we have a very thin base of primary care. We have half as many people going into family medicine today as there were 15, 20 years ago. It doesn't pay near as well. It's not tend to been the thing that's been celebrated by our university systems, academics. And so I think that's part of the new consciousness coming is we have to really reorient the system. People talk about a pyramid of care where you start with a pace of primary care and secondary care, which are things like a cardiologist or a kidney specialist or a general surgeon. And then you have the really top-notch tertiary care at the top for very unusual things. We have sort of an inverted pyramid where we've invested a lot in all the technology, all the specialization. So that's where we need to get back and build a much stronger primary care base. So that's the challenge to us providers. And so Mark and I, at a place like UCSF, which is known as a health system for its tertiary care, we're sort of thinking, you know, we're going to have to not, we want to do tertiary care, quaternary care, as brilliantly as it's been done, but that's not enough. We need to really think, how do we coordinate continuously? So a patient who's coming in here can get preventive care, can get care for their chronic condition so they don't need to be in the hospital if they don't need to be there, and that we then preserve those hospital beds, the technology for people who really need something that could dramatically improve their life. But it's forcing us to really think very differently about what it means to provide care, to be a provider of care, and how we think about the whole population. Not just wait for people to get sick and come into our doors, but now we're talking about who are the people we're responsible for here at UCSF Health. Not waiting for people to get sick and come in, but say, you know, there's that person who hasn't got their colon cancer screening test who we're responsible for. Maybe we better reach out to them and make sure they get that test before they present with advanced colon cancer that we then have to do, you know, kind of heroic treatment. How about that person with diabetes that's poorly controlled? How do we get the endocrinologist, the nurse, coach, the pharmacist to all work together? How do we go beyond the kind of doctor-centric model of care? And that's the other thing for providers is it's not all these days just about what can a doctor do. It's how do we work in teams? How do we take, you know, Mark talked about our brilliant nursing colleagues, pharmacists, dentists, and all work together. I mean, it's shocking. Just think about dentistry. This is a thing. You know what the number one chronic disease of children is in the United States? What's the most? Dental caries. Dental disease. It's not asthma. It's not heart disease. It is rotten teeth. That is a 100% preventable condition of childhood. With proper dental care, proper nutrition, proper instructions and education about teeth brushing, things like that, 100% preventable. So we're not saying, wait a minute, it's not enough to go to medical school and kind of think you stop here and then you start here again. Because I can tell you, all those kids come in for their well child care and shots. So why aren't we integrating dental care when as part of just routine well child care? I mean, we talk with Kaiser folks about how do you break these barriers between medicine, dentistry, nursing, pharmacy? How do you realize that actually pharmacists do a really good job managing complex medications like blood thinners and people who are taking it to prevent a stroke? How do we sort of empower pharmacists to work in our teams in a much more effective way? So I'll conclude on that. So it's the two parts of health reform are coverage, but then, my goodness, if you're going to be covered, you should be covered for something that's worth all that money you're spending on your coverage. So we have to totally reform the care. It's eliminating waste, getting to safety, but it's fundamentally rethinking this model towards whole people care, coordinated care, team-based care, so everybody is on the same page working for you as the patient. And that's when you get actually better quality at lower cost, because there's all this wasteful care, like I talked about those ICU stays that you don't need. So that's what we're trying to achieve, not finding cost savings by preventing you from getting something you really need. Goodness, that's the old managed care, right? I mean, how many people remember that, which was a sense, oh, my doctors aren't going to allow me to get that. I'm just saying, I don't think you need that scan because, A, it's a waste of money. B, you really don't want that radiation exposure, do you? That's not good for you. And C, you'll get that little shadow on that scan that you didn't need. And then we're going to have to do 4 more tests and poke a needle into your chest just to tell you that's a benign mistake. And that's actually not good care. So that's where good care is often can be less expensive care if done well in a coordinated way that then is in tune with what patients really want for their goals in healthcare.
You're a tough act to follow. Well, I want to add my welcome to everyone who's taken the time out to come and listen to us and to the organizers for putting me on this panel. I'm with Kaiser Permanente, and for those of you who don't know, we're an organized delivery system where we actually, I think, do many of the things that Dr. Grumbach was alluding to with comprehensive electronic medical record, team-based care, and alignment of clinical and financial incentives. But you know what? It's not easy. And the Affordable Care Act has laid out a number of incentives to try and move the system in that direction, but it took us a long time to get where we are, and it takes a lot of energy. You have to keep pedaling to keep it going. My task was to sort of talk about how ACA, the Affordable Care Act, affects Kaiser, but the fact of the matter is every single page of the law affects Kaiser Permanente in some way as a health plan, as a care delivery system, as a healthcare philanthropy, and as a research enterprise. And I didn't think I could summarize all that in 5 to 10 minutes. So I want to provide a little bit more of an overview of my take on sort of where we are with reform and providers more generally. And I will stipulate to the remarks that have been made already because I didn't find anything to disagree with yet. Pressure's on. So.
No problem.
We'll get there. We'll get there. So the first thing I'd say is that, you know, going forward, disruption and challenges and adaptation are going to be routine. We're just 2 weeks short of the signing of the legislation 4 years ago, and it's been a very tumultuous period. But that's been all the politics and the regulatory process playing itself out. We're actually just now at the beginning of all of this. And this new system of health insurance exchanges and Medi-Cal expansions and beginning steps on changing care delivery, that's just the start. And the guests, so to speak, are just getting to the theme park here to see what it is that we've built. And it's going to be an interesting period for the next few years as more people enter the system, as we see how it works for them, as we see how health plans and providers respond. That's going to keep us going for a while. One of my colleagues is fond of saying, "I just want it to stop. I'll be so glad when implementation is over." And I said, "You know, Medicare was enacted in 1965, and we're still changing something almost on an annual basis. So, but particularly in a rollout for something as large as the Affordable Care Act, that's going to be huge going forward. Second point I'd like to make is that sort of despite the discussions of ACA-related payment cuts, and there are many, they're on, particularly on the hospital side and particularly on the Medicare Advantage side, the law was actually projected to increase health spending on net. You'll recall that if you believe in Congressional Budget Office scoring, which as a former CBO or I have to, the ACA was projected to cost $1 trillion over the first 10 years of its life, and that was fully financed either by taking making revenue reductions on the Medicare side or increasing taxes. But on net, about 40% of that money is new money to the healthcare system. Now, granted, there's going to be a lot of new people coming into the system with new needs and everything else, but globally, we're putting more money in, not less. What we're really doing is moving it a lot of it around in new ways and sometimes trying to stimulate new behaviors on the part of healthcare providers, sometimes because you take the money from the people that can't move, right? So we'll see how that plays out. Now, I also recognize that even as, you know, for somebody, a chief financial officer at a hospital system, you know, I could tell them all I want that there's going to be more money coming into the system and that those people who are coming into your emergency department are going to have health insurance now and you'll have more paying patients and clients. But that sounds pretty indirect, and what's really visible are the adjustments to the annual update in Medicare payments and the adjustments for disproportionate share payments that hospitals that treat a lot of uncompensated care get. That's what's sort of the clear and present challenge that I think folks are seeing. But I do want to remind people that it isn't all about the cuts. There is new money there in the system. The third point, and this has been touched on, is that the Affordable Care Act is really continuing a broader movement towards greater provider accountability for cost and quality. Some of this is pretty direct in the Medicare program, where there are new policies coming online to reduce unwarranted hospital readmissions, to reduce payments for hospital-acquired conditions, to encourage these new so-called accountable care organizations inside of Medicare, where instead of doing everything on a fee-for-service basis, instead taking on some financial risk for caring for a patient as a whole, in a sense trying to get provider organizations to behave like health plans. I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge, but it's there. The same thing was done on the Medicare Advantage program. That's the managed care program in Medicare with the STARS program that rewards high-quality health plans or health plans that are contracting with providers who deliver high-quality care, maybe is the more accurate way to put it. There's also a lot of indirect effects here that, again, are going to generate some interesting kinds of accountability, and we've seen a lot of this discussion as Covered California and the exchanges more generally have rolled out, and a lot of new so-called narrow network plans. And part of that is a natural response on the part of insurers, not us, we have our network, but it's a natural response on the part of insurers that once you change the rules of the insurance market, guaranteed issue, you can't turn people away, you need to provide standardized benefit inside the exchanges, there will be a risk adjustment, it's no longer about finding the healthiest people and avoiding risks. You need to look somewhere else. So one of your tools has been taken away from you. So the tool you're left with is, maybe we better look at who we're contracting with. And if you're a health plan, it's, you know, I need to show quality to be competitive in these exchanges. They're transparent not just on price, but they're transparent on quality as well. So you can't cut corners on that side, but you need to start negotiating a little bit more on who's going to be in your network. And, you know, if you believe the anecdotes, it's not just the plans that are negotiating for their networks and the patients they'll cover through the exchanges. It's, well, if you want access to my big PPO network and my commercial lives, then you need to take this price on the exchange side. So that's going to force some changes, and we heard some of the reaction here. Some of it will be pushback. Some of it will be, well, we get it. We'll figure out a way to do it more efficiently. Then the last point I don't want to make about reform is that, you know, we are bringing a lot of new people into the care system. The original projections were something like 30, 33 million of those 50 million uninsured. We're not going to get there, obviously, as quickly as we thought. It's everything takes longer than you think it will, but we're directionally correct. A lot of those folks are going to come in with a lot of unmet care needs. Those people who had a pre-existing condition couldn't get coverage couldn't get insurance coverage and just sort of let things ride. The people who maybe didn't have a pre-existing condition because they hadn't been to see a doctor in a couple of years, so they didn't know what they've got. Those people are coming into the system, and they will require new resources. So when I said more money's going in, yeah, it's actually going to be needed. But that also raises issues for system capacity going forward. You know, in California, we had, what, 6 million, Garrett? 6 million uninsured here. The literature says that people who are uninsured use about half the resources of people, similar people who have health insurance. So if you buy into that, that means we're roughly adding, over time, about 3 million new lives with the same delivery system. Something needs to give, and the give is we're going to need to be a lot more efficient about how we care for those people. Some of those people will be new to the world of health insurance, and there's an interesting question about their care-seeking behavior. Will they continue to get their primary care in hospital emergency departments? Or will they learn to sort of work the rules the way, you know, middle-income, high-income insured people and people with Medicare have been doing for years and, you know, circling around a primary care doctor? Many are coming from disadvantaged populations. Some will have language barriers. As providers, we're going to be seeing different people than we've seen before, and we're going to need to figure out a way to accommodate them. We need to meet them. They don't need to meet us. And then I would just close on that last point. These are precisely the people that the Affordable Care Act was intended to reach, right? It raises challenges for all of us. It raises challenges for UC. It raises challenges for Kaiser. It raises challenges for Palo Alto, which we'll hear about in a moment. But, you know, we have an obligation to take care of those people and bring them inside our system. And I agree, 50 million uninsured. I get to speak a lot to international visitors coming to Kaiser Permanente, and that's the number one question in their minds is, how do you Americans live with yourselves with 50 million uninsured? And I have never been able to give them a good answer to that. Now, hopefully I won't have to.
Well, it's a real treat to be here this evening. And I've just been fascinated to hear these comments, and it's fun to bat cleanup. I want to just let you know a little bit about where I come from. The Palo Alto Medical Foundation is a not-for-profit, community benefit, multi-specialty medical group formed in 1930, so over 80 years of experience in doing what Dr. Grumbach was talking about, working as hard as we can to really coordinate care. That's been the essence of the team, if you will, working together. Nearly 1,300 doctors, half are primary care physicians, half are specialists, care for about 900,000 patients, don't have any hospitals. So on the peninsula in Silicon Valley, we work at Mills Peninsula Hospital, at Stanford, at Sequoia Hospital, El Camino Hospital, Washington Hospital over in Fremont, Dominican Hospital over in Santa Cruz. We're not a health plan. We work with all the health plans, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Aetna, Cigna, United Healthcare, and HealthNet. The Affordable Care Act, as has been mentioned, is about access. So what's the impact of access going to be on our population? Well, I don't know. We're participating on the exchange with two of the insurers, Blue Shield and HealthNet, and I don't know whether we're going to see a significant increase in patients or not on the exchange. We happen to be in a part of the state or part of the country or part of the world that has very high employment. The economy is booming, and we don't have the numbers without insurance that exist elsewhere in the state. The second part of access is there will be an equal number of folks already have signed up new to Medi-Cal as those who are signing up on the exchange for the insurance products, commercial insurance products. And I don't know how many new Medi-Cal patients we will be seeing either. So time will tell what the impact of the access improvement will be. However, the most important thing to me about the Affordable Care Act is the affordable part of it. Certainly access to providing insurance access to 25, 30, 40, 50 million folks is critical. But our society cannot tolerate the current cost of health care. So this 18% of GDP, which was programmed to go to 25% of GDP at the spend rate, which was existent a few years ago, is just completely unsustainable. So our activity has to be focused on the affordable part of the Affordable Care Act. And it's hard, as has been explained, because there's a lot of fixed institutions and fixed components of the current healthcare system which are benefiting from it. The pharmaceutical industry, medical device industry, the hospital industry, the physicians, insurance companies. So no change is beneficial to everyone in the healthcare system. Now, as Dr. Grumbach talked about, how do we enhance the health of the population that we're serving? And that's our challenge to do that, continuously increasing our value, i.e. the quality of what we're doing. So what are we doing at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation? Well, first, 3 years ago, we adopted Lean as an operating system. Lean has kind of been called the Toyota production method. We're not making cars, but it's a system that I presume some of you know about that really focuses on employee engagement and the continuous, relentless pursuit of waste in systems and processes. We're 3 years into that. We've had some progress, but more it's been a conditioning of every employee to understand that one of their jobs is to look for waste in the system. Number two, we have a very nationally recognized variation reduction program. And that focuses a little bit on what was early mentioned at what you're trying to do with the UC system. But this involves having each of the specialties get together as departments, provide them with data, often from insurance companies, looking at the total cost for episodes of care. It can be a surgical procedure. It can be care of someone with sinusitis. It can be a care of asthma. And looking at the variation, and there is phenomenal variation in our organization where physicians were trained to do something in a certain way, and their professors that they looked up to said, this is the way you do it. And now it's 10, 15, 20, 30 years later. The world has turned. The opportunities have changed. So when you use the term best practice, that's a continuously evolving term. But we spent a lot of time thinking and working on that. We've saved $50 million in the last 2 years in variation reduction, and none of this is in the hospital setting. This is all in the outpatient ambulatory setting. And I think we have just barely touched the surface as far as the opportunity. So when we look at the management of cost, that's critical. The comment was made that high deductibles are prevalent now. Transparency is essential. No one in this room, I think, knows what the cost of anything really is. I don't know what the real cost of anything is, but we're going transparent with our pricing at least so that you can go on our website. All of 600,000 of our adult patients communicate with us online. Our prices, at least next week, will be, our charges, if you will be online. And our charges turn out to be exactly what the insurance companies pay us. So in contrast to the charge master challenge of the inpatient institutions, we don't have that. So we can be transparent about that. Only about 15% of our patients are in a prepaid model to present time. Kaiser's 100% in that model. 20 years ago, we had 50% of our patients in a prepaid model. We want to take accountability for the total cost of care and enhance the quality of life for all of our patients. So we're going to assume responsibility for our non-HMO patients, our non-prepaid patients, our PPO patients or discounted fee-for-service patients, and take responsibility for their total cost of care, including pharmacy, including hospital costs, et cetera. Well, that's risky because we don't control the hospitals we work with. I just named five of them. So we need to partner with those hospitals, align incentives, and help them manage their costs, help with that continuum of care, help with that care coordination in and out of the hospital. Comment was made about end-of-life care. I'm really proud that we have a program started in Santa Cruz, also nationally recognized now and spread throughout our organization, that is a palliative care advanced illness management program. It's before hospice. So it's for those in the last few years of life who you have that crucial conversation and really talk about what's important to them. And most important, it has to include their family, because you use the example of the child. Very often, if that conversation hasn't been held, the family says, keep mom alive, keep dad alive, without really understanding what mom or dad want. So having those critical conversations, making it convenient to have support in the home. I think 88% of the population die in a hospital. I may be wrong, it's something like that. And I don't think anyone wants to die in a hospital. So huge opportunity there. In the Medicare world, 40% of all health care expenditures in Medicare is the last year of life. You don't know when the last year of life is, but huge opportunities there. All of this that I've just mentioned won't get us to where we need to get. And the current healthcare system needs to be reinvented. I think Dr. Grumbach was referring to the role of the physician in the future. I'm not sure that there aren't enough physicians being trained. I'm actually expect that there will be more primary care physicians trained as opposed to specialty physicians in the future. I think that evolution will occur. However, the physician has to be a leader of a team in the future, not thinking that he or she will be directly seeing every patient at every visit. We have to be using nurse practitioners, physician assistants, healthcare coaches, community health workers. No one would have designed a care delivery system the way we've evolved in this country. So we have to really rethink how we do things and reinvent it. Part of it is the people we use, and I've just made reference to how we have to address that. Part of it is the engagement of our patients to gain responsibility, accountability for their own care, both preventive and when they have a problem. How can we be educators and teach our patients, teach the citizens of our community to be able to care for themselves? We have a program at our Innovation Center which is focused on successful aging. And it's all about linkages with the community. The number one risk for premature death in a senior is loneliness. It's loneliness. It's isolation. So we've developed a program, we call it Linkages. It's actually a time bank that is connecting folks with their church, with their community center, with their senior center. It's just connectivity that connectivity with family and those who don't have family with friends and others so that we can figure out how to provide care at home instead of in a hospital setting or in a clinic setting. The third critical component that's been mentioned is technology, and it's just fascinating. I mentioned earlier that I've had the privilege of having my surgical career in a hospital that had an electronic medical record. First in the country, 1970 it was put in. So I've never handwritten an order and always used it as a computerized order entry. And I'm an old guy compared to most of the physicians these days who are much more computer literate. But the physician's pen and or computerized order entry drives all the healthcare expenditures because the physicians do all the admissions to the hospital, they do all the procedures, they order all the tests, and they all order all the pharmaceuticals. So the physician is key to getting a handle on this healthcare challenge. When I talk about technology, besides electronic medical record, Kaiser and our organization has e-connectivity with essentially all of our patients. That means the medical record is available to the individual and hopefully the entire medical record. There's something called open notes. Right now what's available are selective, your medications, your allergies, procedures, EKG, but not all the physician's notes. That will be coming shortly, as will all the notes that the nurses in the building here are writing or typing in continuously. So that transparency about information, I think, will be critical to educating our population. Other technologies, just think of apps on the iPhone. Take the iPhone, put it on your chest, get an EKG. Take the iPhone, put it on a mole, and 98% accuracy as to whether that mole is malignant or not. Well, that really reinvents the need for dermatology, doesn't it? It really changes the number of office visits a population needs. Think about telemedicine. I used to think about telemedicine as the primary care doc out in the boonies connecting with the specialist at the medical center. That's not telemedicine. Telemedicine now is Skype. It's having a secure methodology of having an office visit from your home or from your place at work. And this is happening now and will happen, and that's going to radically change the number of times a patient needs to come into an expensive building for a procedure. So what's the target here? There's been no increase in reimbursement to physicians by Medicare for 14 years. The inflation rate, 3% a year for 14 years, 2% a year for 14 years, 30, 40% inflation rate. How in the world is a provider to survive on Medicare reimbursement? What does a single payer system mean? It means Medicare for all. So we are really challenged to reinvent the way we have a system. The operating costs for the Palo Alto Medical Foundation right now are about 150% of Medicare. So if we went to a single payer system, Medicare for all, which is what many are pushing for, we'd have to close our doors. Can't do it with our current system. The losses on Medicare at UC, I'm sure, are significant, staggering. So the current system can't work going forward. And when I say reinvent, I'm really serious. So it's technology, it's using people differently, and it's patient engagement that are what the Affordable Care Act to me is all about. Lots of pilots, accountable care organization pilots, a whole host of pilots, and hopefully out of these will come a different way to deliver care. It's complicated. Regulatory environment, again, I'll use the term the guilds, the protectionism, huge obstructions, but they've got to be surmounted. Thanks.
Darren, can I steal the mic for 30 seconds? I just wanted to follow up on your point about technology and electronic medical records. There's two ways to think about electronic medical records. One is having all of the information for a person at the right place at the right time. And that's a challenge, but it's not an insurmountable challenge. The real problem there has been, and this was alluded to before, financial incentives. That why would I, in a physician practice, invest in something that's going to save hospital spending down the road that I never see? We can overcome that if we can fix the incentives there. But the other piece of electronic medical records is when you can use them to look at your entire population, when you can pair them up with your best practices, your clinical practice guidelines, and it's no longer show me my sick patients, it's show me my sick patients who aren't getting the treatment that our own practice guidelines call for, so that you can do the outreach to them. We do this routinely for preventive screening, but you can do it for a lot of other things. And that's something that requires a decision maker sort of in charge of a patient to be able to do. Again, it's not huge high tech. It's being done. It's the system change that's needed.
The electronic medical record is a huge safety enhancement, as Mark pointed out. It's not easy for physicians to use. And the biggest challenge to physicians is the documentation requirement with the electronic record. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, if someone came in with a cold or URI, the medical record handwritten would say cold, and that'd probably be it. Now there's got to be complete documentation in order to get reimbursed for it. And technology is available, like voice recognition, to help with that, but then that information isn't really retrievable for any data analysis, as you're talking about. So one of the things that I'm fascinated with, and we're working with a company, I just want to explain this to you real quickly. The physician is wearing Google glasses. There is a scribe in India that is costing $6 to $7 an hour, which is fair compensation there. And the physician is talking while he or she is doing the exam. The scribe can see what he's talking about, and the scribe is doing the documentation electronically in our electronic medical record. Now, this is a pilot. Let you know a year from now how it works out. But it's an example of a way to enable that physician to actually work much, much more efficiently. I'm sure Dr. Grumbach can comment on the work involved in documentation. Just wanted to mention the use of technology.
Well, great. That has been a phenomenally thoughtful panel. As we're going to open this up for questions, I do want to take the liberty real quick of one question, which jumps to my mind, which is, you know, it's been more than 15 years since the Institute of Medicine put out its groundbreaking report to Air is to Be Human. And here we are. We've been sort of documenting a lot of these efforts or needs for change for quite some time. So why now? Why now with the ACA are we really getting serious about the triple aims and really sort of ratcheting up the implementation efforts to improve what we do in healthcare delivery? Anyone want to take that shot? What's taking us so long?
Kevin, you want to do that? I'll take it. I'll give you one crack.
It's not the doctors. It's obviously the hospital administrators.
It's the hospital administrators that are the problem.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think, in fact, it might have been in this room in the year 2000 when we had our first presentation on how UCSF stacked up on core measures relative to others. And it was a shock because UCSF is accustomed to being the best. You know, we're number one in all these things. And when we learned that we weren't very good at doing smoking cessation counseling, a pretty basic thing, people, well, yeah, that ought to be somebody else's job. You know, we're here solving the big problems, and the little things ought to be handled by somebody else. And that's kind of where that was our mindset. Of course, we challenged the data first. That's always the first thing you do. Then we moved on to a rationalization of it. But I think the big change has been the recognition that, goodness gracious, we actually are responsible for the well-being of the whole patient. And it's not just that liver transplant, but what might we have done to help provide guidelines for the primary care physician for better management of the patient coming in, and certainly what is the follow-up to make sure the patient doesn't have an untoward outcome afterwards? I'll just give you one example. Readmission to hospital for heart failure patients. So the average, you know, is about, I think nationally, about 25% of heart failure patients get readmitted to a hospital within the next month. And this has been a focal point of Medicare and everybody to reduce payments for hospitals that have that problem. So with the help of a gift from the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, we hired two nurses that did nothing but just work with those patients, our heart failure patients. So as soon as they were discharged, they followed them to home. They followed them to the skilled nursing facility. We did everything. And one of the things we learned is when we told the patient low sodium diet on discharge, that didn't exactly mean the same thing to the patient as we thought it meant. And the skilled nursing facility didn't understand it either. And so often these patients would find themselves out of control and bounce back in. And so with that extra effort, we cut in half our readmission rate. So it's little things that are big things. And I think that's the biggest thing that we took from, I mean, there were a lot of things we took from those two seminal reports, but one of them was get focused on these basic issues. They have as much to do with the outcome for patients as the big things that you normally do.
Yeah, and just to extend, I think the fact that we have availability to data and are using the data now makes a big difference.
Okay, there's lots of great questions. So I will call on folks and then ask a question. I'll try to paraphrase so that it gets recorded, and we'll go for there. Let me go to the back. So I believe the question, just to repeat the question for the recording, you know, one of the challenges is the incredible cost of medical education, the debt load that those folks take going into those fields, and how do we square the fact that we have certain high areas of need that may not square with where we're investing in medical education? Does that sound about right? Okay, great. You want to take that on?
No, thanks for your question. You're pointing out something that is really so true. I mean, people are graduating from medical school incredibly indebted from their education, which is influencing then the career trajectories they want to go. I graduated from UCSF Medical School in 1985. The tuition and fees I paid that much, how many, anybody takers, how much do you think it cost per year to go to medical school in 1984, 83? It's about $3,000 a year. I would say the tuition and fees now are $35,000 a year. Because the state has pretty much, that's not Jack's fault. I mean, or maybe it is. I can blame. We'll blame Jack. It's definitely Mark's fault. That's because I always no. But it's the state has pretty much disavowed their sense of investment in higher education and public education. It was a public good, and so when I graduated, I knew I could make more money as a radiologist or an anesthesiologist than a family doctor. But I was really interested in family medicine, and I didn't have to make then sudden huge sense of this giant economic trade-off. It's very different for students coming out now. I think it gets back to we should invest in it as a public good, and then we should hold our graduates accountable for serving the public's need. And that's what most nations do again. I mean, public medical school is publicly subsidized in all developed nations, and there is an expectation then that government partly gets to say which specialties are needed and what area in a way that we're reluctant to do here. Now, there is some trade-off, and we need to do more. So right now, you can qualify for things like the National Service Corps, loan repayment. There are public loan repayment programs. So if you're willing to work in an underserved clinic as a primary care doctor, sometimes psychiatrist, general surgery, you can get $40,000 a year or so for 3-4 years to pay off your debt. The issue is those have been in limited supply. Now, the Affordable Care Act increased the number of positions funded, and the president just last week announced his goal was to fund even more of those loan repayment programs, which I think are critical, because then it's a very different equation. Say, yeah, maybe I could erase my medical school debt if I'm willing to work in an inner city practice, in a rural practice, doing primary care. So I would say you don't get to medical school by not being able to count. That is on the MCAT. There is actually some arithmetic you have to do. And so people are making decisions. So we, you know, I may decry, I wish more people would go into family medicine or, you know, adult medicine or child psychiatry. But people, until we change the financial equation, and that's where I think all of our responsibility collectively is to say, what do we want to invest in? And then what do we expect in return for that public investment in the idea of a career of service and really feeling like you should be going where the need is greatest?
Is there any last minute?
Well, let me just add on to that. You've heard tonight that all of us think that our delivery system is broke. I would say our education system, particularly for educating doctors, is broke. It hasn't changed since 1910. And there's got to be a better way to educate the students that we're now educating. We had a day at UCSF a couple of weeks ago where we were meeting with students, et cetera, to get the idea, get some ideas as to what the UCSF community was looking for in terms of the new chancellor. And several students brought up this issue of debt. And one student said, look, it's only 2%. The tuition represents 2% of the revenue for the School of Medicine. Can't you do something about that relatively small percentage? Now, I understand that it's a percentage that's not committed, it's not restricted, but it is overall a relatively small proportion, and the debt is huge. So we got to be able to fix this ourselves.
Okay, is the ACA the death knell of private practice?
I'm going to take care of maybe. You want to start, Richard, and then we'll come back. That's a very astute observation, and the panel's stacked a bit because you have basically organized systems of care here, and you don't have a panelist who's self-employed doctor, whether primary care or other, out there. California is much farther ahead than many places in the country in the sense of integrated systems. Kaiser, I think we all have to acknowledge, Kaiser has been a leader, and we've seen it's a high-performing organization, I think, that really provides more integrated and a frankly better value proposition in many ways. I mean, it has some deficiencies, but I'll let Murray point those out a little bit more for you. But this is a big question. Now, there is a down. The downside is people like that personal care. I don't know where you get all your care as patients, but people like that idea of a small office. People know me. I'm not a faceless number on the chart. It's not some giant bureaucracy. And I think that has been a little bit the downside of Kaiser, is they sort of centralize it at one big office building down on Geary Street there,
And people, that was a quite. Now, what Kaiser is learning is maybe we have to be a little bit more like that small, you know, personal touch within an organized system. So that would probably be the ideal thing from my point of view, would be the personal touch and a sense of, you know, out in the community practices, but that are integrated, because you need it for electronic medical records. I want to be able to know who the specialists I'm working with are. So I think I would say the system is going to make it very hard for the purely independent doctor to actually survive in this environment. I think they need too much help with all the infrastructure, all the change, all of the quality numbers to do that. I think our challenge is not to make it this big industrial model of monolithic healthcare, but to keep that personal touch. And again, to me, that really then emphasizes primary care in the sense of an organized health system. So,
well, a couple of thoughts. First, personalized care can be in primary care and specialty care. The article you read is accurate. In California, in the Bay Area, I've been surprised. If we'd had this conversation 15 years ago, I would have thought that the individual practice would have been squeezed out because of all of the regulatory challenges, meaningful use, the requirement for electronic records, et cetera. But remember, the individual practitioner is operating at a lower cost point. They may have a spouse or a niece or someone working in their office. They're doing their own billing. They figured out a way to survive because they're at a much lower operating cost point than organized systems of care because of all the overhead. I still think that the new practitioner completing their training wants to join an organized system of care, whether it's Kaiser, our organization, and that seems to be what's happening. To just follow up on one other comment, I do see a very, very bright future for the primary care physician, because if you look at what the market wants right now, there's just huge demand, and when there's that demand and more limited supply, that means the reimbursement goes up.
I know so, recruit my graduates better than I can. So
well, when I said we have a 50-50 mix, that's what's critical. So I actually am very bullish on the future need and positive fortune for the primary care physician.
The question was on how do we deal with specialty pharmaceutical costs, so I'll turn it over.
I mean, thanks for the question. Look, there's one thing we haven't addressed, which is profit. We've talked about managing care better, but look, there are shameful profits in the healthcare system. Somebody once said it's a wealth care system, not a healthcare system. Now, we'll pick on the pharmaceutical industry, then I'm going to turn to all of us here as well to take our licks. Pharmaceutical industry, the profitability is the highest of any industry. I mean, it's a percent of profits relative to their actual sales. Why do we accept that? Why do we just say that you should pay that price? And the market has never solved that. I'm sorry. There is not a competitive market for pharmaceutical products. Every country has figured that out. You can buy the same drugs that you're responsible for purchasing or overseeing for your health benefits folks at two-thirds the cost, 50% of the cost in Canada, in France, in Germany. You just name the country because they regulate the price. And I'm sorry, it doesn't seem that that's put the pharmaceutical companies out of business. We basically have sort of let them get away with us subsidizing their profits, you know, at our expense. I don't see any market solution. I think you have to have actually regulated prices for drugs. Now, let's come back to that. There's profits in all sectors. There's physicians that are, frankly, we need to tackle physicians who expect to make, I think, ridiculous earnings and accept payment from drug companies to go market products and things like that as a way of enhancing their incomes that I think is just prostituting themselves and not being truly evidence-based physicians. So I think we need to do a much better job of taking this on. I think we need, you know, look at biomedical equipment. People did this stuff on what you pay for that piece of metal in an implant in the United States. We pay 3-4 times the price, and you can get it in Belgium or something, because we just accept this. And so I think we need to tackle profits that don't add value to anybody's care. But it's very the idea that we're going to do that through. The market has not succeeded. I'm revealing my inkling. At some point, you do have to sort of put in some regulatory oversight, which we've been reluctant to do politically. But the result is that people are shamefully making off with profits that benefit none of us, truly trying to deliver care or getting care.
Okay, I'll just make a real quick comment. You know,
I agree.
No, yeah, I always agree with you, Kevin. Look, let's give pharmaceuticals its due. Look at the progress that's been made and over the last number of years, and how many probably people in this room are alive today because of the advances in pharmaceutical practice. If we had a group of pharma people up here, what would they be saying? They'd be saying the FDA kills us, and we can't get drugs approved in this country, and that's why all they focus on are pharmacotherapeutics and erectile dysfunction and creating an illness called
testosterone
low T. So, you know, it's a ridiculous situation. But here, I'll give you what I think is a positive result of the ACA. Just the very fact that you are now facile on the cost of your meds, you know, you're pushing that back on us. I'll tell you, every month we sit in something called the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, and we decide which drugs we're going to add to our formulary to offer. And no more are we just saying, well, Dr. Grumbach wants to put it on, you know, and maybe Dr. Grumbach, well, probably wouldn't be him out speaking for the pharmaceutical company, but maybe somebody is out doing it, and no more of that. We're saying you have to show tremendous amount of efficacy, and we're going to push back like heck on the price. So I think the ACA is having a positive impact, but I think we still need to solve a lot of the regulatory issues in the country.
Just very quickly, I agree that we need to have a social conversation on pricing. We've gotten, just in the past year, several new drugs coming on stream for hep C, for lymphoma, for cystic fibrosis, that are sort of testing that upper bound of willingness to pay. There are things, as you note, that the healthcare system needs to be doing, and that's to push back a little bit where you have evidence. When a manufacturer comes to us and says, well, you know, we have male and female knees that we're offering, our response is, well, does it make a difference? Are we willing to pay that extra difference? Well, we'll put them in at the existing price. We'll study it, and we'll see. And if we don't see a difference, we're not going to pay. But you know, some systems are in a position to push back like that because they can use the formulary to create competition, but our sort of more atomistic system has a hard time with it.
Pharmacy is interesting. If I think back, we used to target 60% of all prescriptions being generic drugs, and then 70%, and then 80%, and now it's 90% that we expect our physicians to be using generics. On the flip side, the whole field of genomics, precision medicine, personalized medicine, orphan drug development is skyrocketing. And I'm very concerned that it's more than just a hep C drug and a lymphoma drug. There are going to be hundreds of drugs that are really targeted for very specific diseases, small utilization, but fantastic effectiveness. So this is a huge societal challenge.
Right?
Yeah. Please join me in thanking the panelists.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.